Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. Here's some news from the Kansas City movie scene. The most technologically advanced theater in the entire country may have just opened right here in our backyard. Today, our independent film critics will talk about that in a new movie that Bob Butler just issued a grade of A to, and that is Ida, set in 1960s Poland, that centers on a dark family secret. We'll also talk about Cold in July, a revenge flick about two fathers pitted against each other, and The Immigrant, about a Polish immigrant fresh off the boat who falls prey to a conniving man. With us once again today is film professor Cynthia Haynes. Cynthia, welcome.
Thank you very much, Steve.
KCUR's Steve Walker is also here. Stephen?
I am here. Thanks.
And Bob Butler, who works for the Kansas City Public Library, and he writes about film at butlerscinemascene.com. Bob, how are you?
Good day for the movies.
Good. Cynthia, the most technologically advanced theater in the U.S., where is it? And tell us about it.
Well, I had an interesting experience the other day. I met Rudyard Coltman, who is owner and president and CEO of Cinetopia, which just opened in Overland Park at 135th and Knoll in the Prairie Fire development.
Yes, Prairie Fire.
And he put $25 million into building this megaplex. It has 1,900 seats, 17 theaters, and three different types of theaters, including living rooms and movie parlors. And some of those theaters are 21 and over, if you don't want to share your movie experience with teenagers.
Wow. So there's no nursery theater, thank God.
Okay. No. Some 75-foot screens, 300.
75-foot screens, Cynthia?
I mean, IMAX territory. 360-degree sound with 128 channels. And he described it, the picture quality is four times Blu-ray. It's known as 4K, which, you know, I mean, how much sharper can you possibly get?
Wow.
And he's got a wine bar, a restaurant, Vinotopia, and it's just an amazing experience.
Have you seen the film there?
Yes, I saw The Immigrant there.
And I bet that was a great film to see on a screen that large.
Well, fortunately, I mean, it made sense to put it in one of the smaller theaters, which was an intimate experience. You know, I forgot how many chairs were in there, but it was very comfortable. I was impressed by the fact that he was showing The Immigrant and Locke, two independent films we'll be talking about today. I notice in today's paper, you know, we've got X-Men and Edge of the Earth or Edge of the World.
Maleficent.
Maleficent, yeah. And it's just a pretty amazing experience.
That sounds pretty cool. I'd like to go out there and see it for myself. That sounds great. Okay, let's move to some films that have just opened. And our first film is Ida, set in Poland during the 1960s. Ida is a story of a young a nun on the verge of taking her vows who discovers a horrible family secret, Bob Butler.
This one blew me away, everybody. This is a terrific movie set, as you say, in early 60s Poland. Anna is a young nun. Before she takes her vows, Mother Superior says, "We've kept this from you, but you've got a living relative. You got to go visit her." Here's a woman that grew up in a convent. She knows nothing of the world. She goes off to meet her Aunt Wanda. Aunt Wanda is a communist a magistrate. She used to oversee commie war trials and things like this. She's an alcoholic. When the nice young nun shows up, she's shooing a man out of her bedroom. They go on a road trip to the town where their families came from. Aunt Wanda, one of the first things she says is, "Your name isn't Anna. It's Ida. Ida Liebenstein. You're a Jew. You're a Jewish nun."
Mm.
She has an attitude, this aunt. They go off on this road trip. They go looking for secrets. Their entire family, aside from these two women, died in the war. How they died is a mystery, and they're going to find out. So you've got this mystery aspect of it. The film was made by a guy named Paweł Pawłowski, who left communist Poland when he was 14, went to England. He's done a lot of movies, a lot of documentaries. This is the first one he's done in his native country. I understand it's raised a little heat because he is not kind toward Poland's record treatment of the Jews during World War II. And that's part of it. It's about national guilt. At the same time, it's about these two women affecting each other's lives. The actresses involved are fantastic. Wanda, Aunt Wanda, is played by Agata Kulesza, who is a very well-known, in Poland at least, film actress. I like to describe her as Claire Bloom after a rough night. She's in her mid-40s, and, you know, she lives life hard. She's a cynic. She no longer even believes in communism. She's a person without any faith.
Yeah.
Then you've got Agatha Tribuchowska, if I'm mangling these, I apologize, who isn't an actress, but she is a young woman with huge eyes. She reminded me of the Star Child at the end of 2001. She takes all this stuff in, and you're never quite sure whether she's being seduced by this new world or if she's somehow keeping her spiritual resolve and fighting it off. So you've got personal stories, you've got national stories, you've got so much stuff going on in this movie. And I haven't even got to one of the best things, filmed in the most exquisite black and white I've ever seen.
Wow.
You actually want to put out your hand and touch the screen because the fabric and their clothing, you're sure you could actually feel the texture. It's amazing.
Bob Butler gave this movie an A. Steve Walker, do you give it an A?
I would give it an A. It's on my 3 to see. I really wanted to write a review, just didn't have time this week. What I found so extraordinary about it is, besides the history and the family secret, is their contradictory lives and philosophies. Whereas the older one chastises Ida's piety. She kind of makes fun of her for praying before meals. Ida watches this woman, this wanton drunk,
yeah,
live her life and kind of looks at her in horror. But what is most profound is how in their shared grief they find tenderness with each other.
Mm.
And that family bond oversees everything else. It's a beautiful film.
Cynthia?
I thought it was brilliant. I give it an A also.
Wow.
How many stars or whatever.
I haven't heard you guys much unanimity in here over one film in a long time.
I think one of the things that really struck me was the cinematography and the framing of the film. It's all so simple but profound. And it's just a joy for us to, you know, slog through how many movies that we really don't like, and then to sit there just mesmerized by the images you see on the screen. The choice to do it in black and white was brilliant.
Mm-hmm. And it's in a box format. It's not, if you go to a huge wide screen, you're going to see, why are they cutting off the sides of the screen? Mm-hmm. It's because he did that purposefully.
And the sense is that this was a movie made possibly back in the 40s or 50s. Mm-hmm. And you can look at some of the great filmmakers of all time and say, well, maybe Bresson made that film, or it's just that good, that special.
And we call it, we're describing it as Ida because Steve Walker.
Because that's how they pronounce it in
Ida.
The film. It's spelled IDA. So if you're looking for EEDA or something like that, you're not going to find it.
And we want to mention it is at the Tivoli and the Glenwood Arts.
Well, three huge, big, wide, long thumbs up for Ida, just opening up today here in town. Films that are already open, Cynthia Haynes, let's go to Cold in July in East Texas in 1982. Two fathers are pitted against each other in this neo-noir revenge flick.
Now, this is the opposite end of the spectrum for me, that I had to sit through something like this. I mean, the director, Jim Mickle, from what I understand, comes from horror film genre, and he's made – it's a very clever plot, no doubt about it. And he's got some very good actors in it, but I just don't think – I blame the director for keeping it from following a straight track. It's Michael C. Hall, as we know him from Dexter and 6 Feet Under, stars as kind of a milquetoast frame shop owner named Richard Dane, and he kills a low-life burglar who's broken into his home, and then Dane is hailed as a hero in the town, but he's really reluctant to accept any praise. Then he finds out that the dead man's father, who's played by the wonderful Sam Shepard, I mean, he's just terrific in this part, is released from prison, and he set out to seek revenge. So then a clever plot twist evolves, and then we see a cartoonish pig farmer slash private detective who's played by Don Johnson. And for me, that just destroyed the rest of the movie. I mean, he's got longhorns on the front of his Cadillac. He's, you know, wearing outrageous Western wear. And
a stereotype, it sounds like.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So so for what it's worth, I just think it's not worth anybody's time to see.
I kind of liked it, actually. And I reviewed it on our website, was on my 3 to see for a couple weeks.
For an opposing viewpoint, we turned to Steve Walker.
Yes, yeah. Well, the always contrary Steve Walker. What I think elevates it above most run-of-the-mill kinds of movies is that did remind me, in a way, it's not as good, of Blood Simple. It's this Texas noir set out in this vast landscape, The performances of Hall and Shepard and Don Johnson, even, I think, are really good. I think they're fun to watch together. And the cinematography is amazing. There's a 10-minute shootout scene at the end that mixes tight and deep focus, and one side of the screen is one color because of the lighting of where they are or where they're hiding. I thought it was very well done, the last half hour. There's a very unpleasant sub-theme around this, and that is that Sam Shepard discovers that his son makes snuff films. Mm-hmm. So that's very, very tawdry and unpleasant to watch a clip from this fake snuff film. We didn't need to see that. We could have watched Michael C. Hall's face and Sam Shepard's face.
Yeah.
Other than that, I think it's bloody, it's gruesome, but it's well done.
We have a clip here from this film.
Did he say anything to you at the school?
No, I just waved.
You waved?
Yeah.
So what do you want me to do here, Rich?
I want him arrested.
For what? He hasn't done anything.
He threatened my son.
He said your boy looks like you. It's not a threat.
He showed up at Jordan's school.
In broad daylight, in front of witnesses, and did nothing.
He wants my son. I know it. I want protection.
That's not going to happen, not without a legal reason. I tell you what I do, Rich. Unofficially, I have a car stop by your house every couple hours over the next few days. Give you a little peace of mind. He's probably just trying to scare you. Don't let him.
Cynthia?
That was the Michael C. Hall's character talking to the sheriff, because he's terrified that Sam Shepard's character is going to come and kill him.
As well he should be, since he finds him in his home.
Okay. So we have different viewpoints on this film, Cold in July. Steve Walker liked it. Cynthia Haynes did not.
Too bloody, too violent for me.
Yeah, I get the picture here. How about a different film here, a very different film? The immigrant, a Polish immigrant, fresh off the boat, falls prey to a conniving man, Steve Walker.
Well, this is from the director James Gray, who's made several films with Joaquin Phoenix and uses him here very well. It opens at Ellis Island, where the Oscar-winning actress Marion Cotillard is arriving from Poland with her sister, and her sister is sick, and they kind of whisk her away, as they did, and so she's kind of left there not knowing the country, not knowing very much English. She does know quite a bit. I mean, there are very few subtitles in this, but Joaquin Phoenix is sort of a manipulative...
Sort of. He is. He really
who
is.
Who spots this innocent, vulnerable woman and says, oh, I just happen to have a place for you to stay. And eventually puts her to work in his nightclub, and then eventually puts her to work at doing more seedy things behind the scenes of this nightclub. And then she also brought into the film is the great actor Jeremy Renner, who plays a magician who works at the nightclub as well. I really liked this movie. I just thought it was very well shot.
It got good reviews.
Joaquin's one. I really like watching him.
And once again, the cinematography is just brilliant in this film. It really makes it. Steve, I think part of my problem was that the three actors, who were all terrific in the film, were playing it at different speeds. I was a little frustrated, too, with waiting for, you know, some energy from Phoenix. And he has a very explosive scene at the end of the film. But, you know, I guess I didn't really see that coming. Marion Cotillard, you know, almost plays it as a seven-year-old, you know. She's just so innocent and naive. And Jeremy Renner, I think, was really quite good.
If you've ever been to New York's Tenement Museum, which is down on the Lower East Side, I highly recommend it. I've been twice. Because this film, when they go into the New York City from Ellis Island, how they filmed this now, I have no idea. But you see the Lower East Side in living color, with people living on top of people in the streets filled with horses and markets and milkmen. Mm. And you really get a sense of the time. And then the apartment she stays in, what the Tenement Museum allows you to do is go into actual tenement apartments from the turn of that century. And that was like, I've been here. I've been in this apartment.
Yeah, that whole period, this was set in 1921, is evoked in the film just brilliantly.
I gather they're small, claustrophobic, all those things?
They're very small, very claustrophobic. There's maybe like a window or a sliding little opening between apartments. They're like, they call them railroad flats. They here's one room, then the next, and the next, and the next, with one hall along wow. one wall.
Wow.
But so, that's exactly what you'll see at the Tenement Museum, and that's what you see in The Immigrant, which I think is very good.
Cynthia?
Just want to mention it's showing at the Glenwood Arts.
Okay. We have a clip here.
Yes,
it's Joaquin Phoenix is there in Ellis Island, has spotted Cotillard.
All right, from The Immigrant.
What's the matter?
I leave my sister here.
Now, do not worry. She's going to get the best medical care available. Do you have a place to stay?
No. Do you know somewhere?
Yeah, I know a place. If you'd like, I can take you there. Yes?
Yes.
Okay.
Very quick. Okay.
There you go.
Highly recommend it.
That's from The Immigrant. Two big thumbs up. Am I hearing
yeah.
that right? Okay. Sounds good. Let's move on here to Hornet's Nest. Bob Butler. It's a documentary about a father-son war correspondence in war-torn Afghanistan.
Yeah, there have been some very famous combat documentaries from World War II, the Battle of Midway, the Battle of San Pietro. I think what makes this movie so good, and I happen to think it's among the handful of the best combat documentaries ever made,
wow.
is that the technology now allows these tiny cameras, which the correspondents can wear on their helmets, and you see exactly what they're seeing in the moment. This film was made by Mike and Carlos Betcher. They are Mike has been around for years.
Yeah, you'd recognize him,
television. Yeah, from television. He is a regular ABC correspondent from war zones.
Right.
There's a little backstory, which isn't terribly important, but because of his dedication to the job, Mike Betcher's marriage broke up, and he really didn't get to know his son Carlos while they were growing up. Well, now Carlos is a man. They go together as father and son war correspondents to Afghanistan. They're embedded with American troops. And it does put a certain pressure on Mike to be there with his son, knowing that his son could catch a bullet at any time. Now, what makes this movie fascinating to me is that it isn't about the politics of the war. No one even talks about it. It is about the reaction of men under combat and how our well-trained, and I got to admit, I admire these guys immensely after seeing this movie, how our troops deal with the act of fighting. We're talking about bullets whizzing by the camera here. It's pretty intense stuff.
Wow.
And we're talking about, while there's all these summer Marvel Comics movies open with all the fake fighting, and given the anniversary of D-Day, I think people owe it to themselves to see the Hornet's Nest. It's down to playing at one place, I believe now, AMC Town
20.
Center.
Yeah.
Oh, no.
I'll admit it, this movie made me cry.
Oh,
it's
gosh.
It's intense.
It's everyone doesn't make it. Every one of these soldiers that we follow.
Steve Walker, Bob Butler called it one of the best war documentaries he's seen.
It's very good. I mean, it's up there with Restrepo, which was really terrific 2 years ago. And I have to say, Bob, in relation to what they do when they're not fighting, they're shown laughing. They've just lost friends of theirs. They're shown laughing and playing with the ducks and the goats.
Throwing a football around, yeah.
And then it ends with this excruciating
We've got a
service.
Clip, and basically an airstrike has been called in on an enemy position. And just the soundtrack will kind of tell you everything you need to know here.
This is from Hornet's Nest.
Hey, Z.
What's up?
Give me eyes on that ridge at your 11.
To believe that soundtrack wasn't sweetened, that they didn't add no. whizzing bullets, and I don't think they did. These guys are Emmy-winning journalists. It's intense stuff.
Yeah.
Cynthia?
This film also made me cry, but it also made me very mad. Mm-hmm. There's a scene in there where he doesn't know whether or not his son Carlos has been killed, and it just infuriated me that he brought him into this combat zone. He knew that could happen, and he put his son at risk. And these are beautiful, beautiful young people. And to see those helmets sitting on top of their boots and realizing how many have been killed, and I don't want to start getting into politics here, but it just was a devastating experience to watch this film.
Wow. Hey, how come we're not hearing more about this film?
That's a good question. I think it's in very limited release. I'm not even sure that it's out nationally yet. I think we're one of the first markets to get it.
Yeah, it opened wider. It opened on five or six screens, and that was 3 weeks ago. And it's hanging on at one screen.
But it's
fighting the Godzillas and the Jolies.
Lone Survivor. I mean, entertainment, it just really bothered me.
I can't help but wonder if one of the filmmakers here had been injured or even killed. I wonder how much more notoriety this film would have, and we'd be having an entirely different conversation here today. And it sounds like, from what you're saying, that very easily could have happened.
Well, several men do die in this mm-hmm. film. This is not a
several.
Fictional film. Yeah. This is a documentary in which young men die.
And you wonder what their families are saying.
Well, yeah. They're treated with such respect and dignity, though. It's powerful.
You know, it's kind of funny because you have that cliche of the Vietnam vet, you know, that burned villages, came back a mental case, blah, blah, blah. These guys, I was just in awe of these young guys, what they're doing. And there's a point where there's a little subplot where they're rushing an injured Afghanistani boy to a medic to get him fixed
That's
up.
That's how it opens.
And their dedication to that,
mm-hmm.
they are trying to win hearts and minds. I don't know if it's working.
Right.
But they're certainly trying.
There's
but,
all those sub things going on. The big picture is political. This film is apolitical completely.
Mm-hmm.
I disagree.
Really?
Yeah.
Just by existing, it's political.
Yes.
Well, I get that this film is not for the faint of heart. This is a fast-moving, a lot of stuff going on.
Well, you're right there.
You're
right there behind the rocks.
And here you go when you walk into the theater.
You don't actually see people getting killed.
No.
But you're squatting in the dirt with bullets whizzing over you. And the camera, because it's on the helmet, you see him hit the dirt, literally. Dirt comes up in your face and you hear things flying over you.
But even worse, if we had seen the actual deaths, almost more painful for me is watching their friends and...
Colleagues
and supervisors deal
with
it.
Saluting them.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So pretty strong reviews here for Hornet's Nest. Okay. Let's do this. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our very good conversation here about the latest art, independent, and foreign films now showing. We'll get to Locke. We'll get to Bell. And we'll also talk about a film, Chef, which I had sort of mixed feelings about, but our reviewers, I think, absolutely loved it. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. Well, this hour we're talking about the latest independent films now showing. We're visiting with film professor Cynthia Haynes, KCUR's Steve Walker, and Bob Butler, who works for the Kansas City Public Library. He writes about film at butlerscinemascene.com. Lots of interesting films today. Let's move on to a film here. It's titled Locke, Steve Walker. It's about a man about to make the most important decision in his life as he spends 85 minutes driving to London.
Right. The movie is entirely... shot within the a car with Tom Hardy, the British actor, driving. He is on the phone with his wife, his son, his mistress. He's actually on the way to London because a woman he had a one-night stand with is about to have a baby. At the same time, he's works for a construction firm, and they're about to pour one of the biggest apartment complexes they've ever worked on the next day. So he's on the phone with colleagues and his underlings and city officials, but it's all him on the phone. I have to say, it's a very interesting concept.
Does it work?
It's a very interesting concept.
Okay, I think I get your drift.
I kind of dozed off a couple times.
Ouch.
I like Tom Hardy a lot. For years. That's what you get. It's him on the phone, you know, like an old radio play. You're not seeing anybody else. It's him, his face, and these other voices are all you see. It's well made. It's very skillfully put together.
It strikes me as such a risk for a filmmaker to make. I mean, you're taking a real flyer coming right out of the gate, and you have to have, some confidence this is going to work, but you're coming at me and saying it didn't really seem to.
That's a good point. I mean, it is really kind of takes a lot of chutzpah to put this movie out there.
Yeah, absolutely.
But it's been playing for, I think it's in its fourth week, and it's now moved to the Screenland Crown Center.
Okay, we have a clip here from it, Steve.
We do. He's on the phone, no surprise, calling home, and his son intercepts the call.
All right.
Hello?
Eddie, it's your dad. Is your mother there?
No, she's not back from the shops yet. She's getting that German beer that you like for the match.
Okay, listen, I won't be back for that.
What?
Something's come up. I can't get out of it.
I'm wearing the shirt. Mum's getting sausages. Oh, yeah, and guess what? She's wearing the shirt as well. Oh, Dad, it's so embarrassing. Yeah, what did you say about coming home?
I won't be back for the match. I'll have to listen to it on the radio.
Dad, you said you'd be back. It's rubbish on the radio. Mum's doing sausages and all.
Is your brother there?
Yeah, do you want a word?
No, you just tell your mother to call me when she gets back. Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah, sure.
I love you.
What?
I will say, in its credit, that you do get to know this man. I mean, he becomes a full-fledged character only through these relationships we're hearing on the phone.
Mm. And that's a credit to
Tom Hardy. And the writer. I think it's well-written as well, yeah.
Okay, a mixed review from Steve Walker for the film Lox, showing at the Screenland Crown Center right now. Okay, let's move on to a film that's gotten a little more attention. It is Belle, Bob Butler. It's about a biracial woman who navigates 18th century British society. It's a British film suggested by a true story.
Yeah, Dido Belle was a real person. She was raised by – she was the daughter of a former slave and a naval officer. At a very young age, she was turned over by her father, who had to go to sea, to live with her uncle and his family. The uncle, played by Tom Wilkinson. Ah, yes, Tom Wilkinson.
Wonderful Tom Wilkinson.
Is England's High Chief Justice. Now, she grows up as a member of the aristocracy. She is a half-white, half-black young woman. Beautiful. She's played by a newcomer named Gugu Mbatha Raw. Don't even ask me to spell that. And you can imagine the issues. There's racism because she is half black. She has to find a husband because that's what women did. Her uncle is involved in a major case that could result in the end of the slave trade in Britain. Some pretty big stuff swirling around here.
Mm-hmm.
I wish I cared more. The movie left me cold emotionally. It's got all these great elements, and it never hooked me. Mm-hmm. I don't know what the problem is. We got great actors. You got Emily Watson. You got Miranda Richardson.
Does the issue, the slavery thing, just feel a little old? Like we've sort of been there, done that?
Well, if you want to see a movie about that, I suggest going to watch Amazing Grace, a movie from about 10 years ago. It was about the outlawing of the slave trade, and it was a tremendous movie. I have women friends that love this because it was about a woman in a situation that modern sensibilities can really appreciate. But still, go ahead.
Go ahead, Cynthia.
Well, I was going to say,
passing the ball right around the horn here.
I've seen it. I want to talk about it too.
Who wants to talk about it?
The screenwriter is Masan Segay. She's an Anglo-Nigerian woman, and she has claimed sole credit for the screenplay. She had seen a painting at the Scone Palace in Scotland. It's a double portrait of two aristocratic women. One is biracial and one is white. And the wall label read, Portrait of Lady Elizabeth Murray, circa 1778. And so Segay wondered who that biracial young woman was in the painting and then took off from there, that the rest of it was basically fiction. She
right.
recreated this dialogue, this story. The filmmaker is British-born of Ghanaian parentage. Her name is Ama Asante, and she had a dispute with, in fact, the woman who claimed she was the screenwriter. And they took it to the Writers Guild of America, and Segay won, and so she's receiving sole credit. Although Tom Wilkinson said he worked entirely from a script that was written by the director. So there's this little controversy going on. I thought I'd just mention
that. But one of your points about this film, Cynthia, is it has the feel of a Jane Austen novel.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Very much so, with the added twist that we've never seen, and that is how a woman of mixed race would fare. And we get to see her humiliation over and over as newcomers come in for dinner. We're having dinner, but you will, of course, eat in the little room we make you eat in when we have company.
Actually, the film is very curious about its approach to the very proper rules. You find out later that it isn't because she's black that she can't eat with the family. It's because she's illegitimate.
Well, one of my reactions to watching the trailer for this film was, okay, tell me something new. Take me to a place I haven't been. It's another film about a person of color being shunned by society. Okay, I've seen it, and I've seen it, and I've seen it.
I would have to tend to agree with you. Okay.
Seldom have you seen such a strong female figure who, in fact, may have affected her
her
uncle's decisions to end slavery.
We got a clip here.
Yes,
and
Papa,
what it is, the two cousins, Dito and her cousin Elizabeth, are both being wooed by brothers.
Who are white.
Aristocratic brothers, right, who are white. And one of these fellas is played by Tom Fenton, who you may recall is snotty little Malco Dreyfoy, or what's his name? From Harry Potter.
Yeah. And he's snotty in this film, too.
He is. He's basically racist. So here we go. They're in a park. They're at a party, and they're getting to know each other.
And this is from Belle.
Oh, Dido, look. Mr. James has made me a boat and it is capsized.
What a dreadful shame.
For you. Miss Lindsay, would you do me the honor of taking some air with me sometime?
Don't you care what people will say?
What is that to mean, Mr. James? What should anyone say?
That he would compromise a lady's reputation by stepping out with her, scarcely having made her acquaintance.
I think you are a great deal too anxious, brother. We should merely take a turn around Vauxhall.
I should be delighted, Mr. Oliver. Most delighted.
Taking some air. I want to take some air sometimes, Cynthia. Yeah.
Segay, the screenwriter, admitted that Belle is sort of an adaptation of Sense and Sensibility, that she used it as a model. But if you like costume dramas, if you're interested somewhat interested at all in this moment in history, it's a movie worth seeing, I think.
That film is Belle. Is it on any of your three to see this week?
No, not mine. No,
might be on mine. I'm not
might
sure.
Might be on yours, but
it's good enough to maybe see there.
Tivoli, Glenwood, Red Bridge.
Okay, let's get into it now on this film,
yes.
Chef. Let's get into this. A film about a frustrated by the high end restaurant business. A celebrity chef takes a trip in a food truck. It's also a father-son bonding movie, and lots of folks loving this movie. I came away with very, very mixed reactions about it. Who wants to talk about this one?
I'll just say right off the bat, I did not see it because Jon Favreau, I don't enjoy watching. So I'll leave it to my colleagues.
Well, okay. And that's how we're going to have it. Cynthia?
Well, Steve, we don't want to get too intellectual about this. I mean, I just saw
this as a fun summer movie. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
And I'm surprised you didn't like it that much.
Well, I was ready to like it. I went into like it, and you have a lot of people really like this film. It's maybe I'm taking too much about
too many grumpy pills. I don't
know. But you know, it's a film about a chef who's frustrated that he can't create more, and he winds up in a food truck creating the same sandwich over and over and over again, and he seems happy. The whole premise of it didn't make a whole lot of sense to me. Then you throw in the wives here and the girlfriends who didn't seem to quite match with the lead actor, and I was lost by the whole thing.
It's the middle of summer.
I know.
This, you know what it is? This is a popcorn movie for the art house, basically.
Well, okay.
It's pretty undemanding. It's lightweight. I didn't dislike it. At the same time, I wanted something more from it. When you talk about food movies, I'm thinking of Big Night, Babette's Feast. I wanted something that would really bowl me over.
Yeah.
This didn't quite do it for me.
I was waiting for that, too, and I didn't get there.
Well, let's backtrack a little bit. Jon Favreau wrote, directed, and starred in this film.
Yes.
It's a low-budget production. He is well-known as director of the Iron Man series, and so he called in a few chits from his buddies in Hollywood. He plays this very passionate creative chef, works in a restaurant owned by a character played by Dustin Hoffman.
Mm-hmm.
Who's very conservative. They have a battle. There's a cute experience between the father, who's very neglectful of his 10-year-old son, and
he's pursuing a career.
Right. And the kid is way into social media, and that factors into the plot of the story because Favreau's character goes into this rant. Oliver Platt plays a food critic.
And his brother, by the way, is the food critic for New York Magazine. I don't know if you knew that.
No.
Really?
Yeah.
And he played the food critic very well.
Oh, yeah. And I think he said what a lot of filmmakers might want to say to us sometimes. I mean, just kind of rants and says, you know, you don't do it. You don't understand it. And so that's what happened with Platt.
That's the problem with the film. The first quarter of it, the first third of it is all based on the sense that this chef wants to expand and breathe a little bit and be creative in the kitchen. He's got that capability. Next thing you know, he's happy on a food truck making sandwiches. Bob.
Making less money.
Right. I cannot wholly endorse any movie that casts Sofia Vergara in a straight role.
Well, and he's married to the chef, and that didn't make any sense. And she's in this incredible house. That didn't make any sense.
Well, no, her ex-husband provided the money.
Yeah, it was Robert Downey Jr.
Now, if you blinked, you missed her, but Amy Sedaris is unrecognizable, absolutely hilarious in this. She's a publicist who works for John Favreau's character's ex-wife, and quite funny. And it becomes a road movie. I think the story stalls a little
bit. It becomes a road movie too?
Oh, yeah. Yes. And
so they head back
to Miami to pick up a food truck, and they drive it across country.
That was kind of fun. And the father something is
Austin
very cool.
And LA.
And that's great.
That's what's going on, is that they're building this rapport.
I'm a journalist. I want reality. I want things to be real.
So what kept me away was hearing that they're showing all these Twitter
little bloopers,
these little tweets up on the screen,
animated bloopers,
it's
and
clever.
I went, "Oh no!"
It's clever.
No.
I think every person who enjoys food trucks, works in a food truck, ought to see this movie.
Everyone who eats food would enjoy this movie. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. Now, get this. All right.
Yeah.
Steve, I don't know if you're going to be going, but tonight from 5 to 8 is Food Truck Friday.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is.
At the Kansas City Star parking lot at the corner of 18th and McGee.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're curious about this food truck phenomenon that's taken over the country.
And Scarlett Johansson and Sofia Vergara will be there. Right?
Yeah,
they're
right.
They'll make you a sandwich.
Right.
Yeah,
they'll make you a Cuban sandwich.
Cuban sandwiches,
but
okay.
Anyway, I did enjoy it. And I'm telling you, it's starting to expand, and I think this is going to be one of those surprise indie hits of the summer.
I think you're probably right about that.
But it's rated R, and that
it's
I don't
rated R?
Know. Yes.
There are a few F-bombs dropped, I believe.
Okay. And that's
I don't
it.
Even
and that's a
anymore.
Shame, because I think every 10-year-old ought to go see this movie.
Well, if our listeners have seen Chef and they want to disagree with what I was ranting about, 816-235-2888.
It's going to go viral.
You're going to go viral. 816-235-2888. Give us a call, and we'll take your calls, and we'll have a debate about
Chef. Did you have
Chef.
A clip to inflict upon us from Chef?
Yes, we did. Yes, I almost missed the clip. Yes.
Ouchie.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah, this is Carl Casper, the Favreau's character, and his son.
Okay.
Dad?
Yeah?
We got 1,653 followers since last night.
Oh, is that good?
It's amazing.
Oh, good. What does it mean?
It means that 1,653 people are reading your Twitter feed.
Mm-hmm. I thought it was like texting.
Did you post anything since last night?
No.
Are you sure?
Yeah, I just sent a private message to somebody.
To who?
To that a-hole food critic.
You could only send private messages to people who are following you. I think you might have posted that publicly.
No, he wrote something nasty about me, and then I hit reply, and it let me send a message to him.
Dad, replies are public. Everybody can read them. And it looks like he retweeted it to all his 123,845 followers. And he wrote back.
What'd he say?
I don't think I should read it.
Just, can you read it to me, please? Read the reply.
At Chef Carl Casper, I would rather have you sit on my face after a brisk walk on a warm day than suffer through that lava cake again.
See, you're laughing.
Well, that Twitter thing was one of the best parts of the movie. The fact that the chef was confused about how to use it, yet replying
he
it goes, I get all that. I can relate to a lot of that, Jeff. We're getting lots of calls here about
we
chef.
Are.
Just
oh.
imagine that. Huh. Let's go to some calls. Deanna from Leawood. Deanna, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Steve, I agree with you completely.
Yes.
I did not like this movie.
Yeah.
I loved Oliver Platt, and that was about it. That was the only person I was sympathetic to in the movie. I thought the main character was completely unsympathetic, and I couldn't understand how he got both Sophia and Scarlett Johansson? Are you kidding me?
Yes. There you go. There you go.
You have to understand the dynamics in a kitchen.
Yeah. Now, Deanna, I appreciate your moral support here because our professional film critics have been looking down their noses at me as I went off on my thing here. So I appreciate that phone call.
Absolutely.
Thanks, Deanna. I appreciate it. Okay. Again, our phone number here, 816-235-2888 if you want to join our conversation about Chef. Again, 816-235-2888. Okay, let's roll on as the calls come in here. We'll move on. We'll come back. We're going to go to Fed Up.
How appropriate.
Yes. Speaking of food.
About the food industry and childhood obesity, Steve Walker.
Fed Up is a documentary, sort of the inconvenient truth of how Americans eat and why our children are so heavy. And it's kind of a rant, a movie-long rant. It's narrated by Katie Couric. What I did bring in, however, and something I learned from the film, is a can of soup, very famous brand.
You are holding in your
hands.
I'm
looking at the nutritional facts, and I did not know this, was I ever aware that, thanks to the sugar lobby, everything in this soup, from fat to sodium to potassium to protein, has next to it what percent that is of your daily diet. For example, the sodium, 480 milligrams in this can of soup, is 20% of your diet.
Yeah.
That you're supposed to have per day. Sugar, 12 grams of sugar, conveniently left out, is what percentage of your daily diet that's supposed to be. And it's on every nutritional label in America. Something
really?
I did not know.
There's sugar in soup?
Oh, there's sugar in everything.
Well, okay, I know that. But,
so the movie really, it's entertaining enough, and it's you know, it makes you question what we eat.
And so you come away there thinking we're all going to die. Right?
And you also come away thinking that every politician has a food lobbyist in their back pocket.
Yeah.
And they're very critical of Michelle Obama, which I found very interesting.
Why?
And kind of,
I thought she was doing the whole physical fitness thing, and
they're from because there is some pressure. She went back on something she had said because of the lobby of one of it, whether it's the sugar lobby or the salt lobby or the
when she first started out with the garden on the White House organic garden, blah blah blah. She was pretty aggressive,
right?
And some of the things she said apparently teed off the food industry, and they came down hard.
Yes. Huh. So you're going to see, yes, sugar is bad.
The politics.
Fat children are unfortunate. They need to move more. We need to take in less than we, you know.
Okay, you're not telling me anything I didn't know before. Is that one of your points here?
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, I brought the soup in only because I was never aware of that. I'm a label reader, and I was like, really? The sugar lobby is that powerful?
Now,
am I naive?
They were able to remove, your point is they were able to remove that percentage of sugar that can of soup that's our daily allotment.
Yes, because there's so much sugar in every single thing, from a granola bar to soup to salad dressing to barbecue sauce to ketchup to, you can't hardly get away
now,
from
it. Now, the third significant ingredient. I'm looking at your can here, mm-hmm. Steve. Ingredients.
I wouldn't touch that line with a...
Ingredients. Tomato puree, which is water and tomato paste. The second largest ingredient in this can is high fructose corn syrup.
Corn syrup in my tomato soup.
Steve, go home and pull out everything in your...
It depresses me to do that. That's the problem with films like this, is you go see them and you leave and you're like, I'm dying. I think I'm eating well, but I find out I'm eating poorly.
There's corn syrup in everything, too.
Tomato soup. Syrup in tomato soup.
If it's not raw sugar, it's some kind of form of corn sugar.
There's no hope for us. That's what
there is hope. There's a section of your grocery store that sells fruit and vegetables.
Yeah.
Now, but also the argument these days is that kids are throwing those healthy foods out in the cafeteria and are refusing to eat the healthy food.
I see it every day at my employer.
The problem is you don't know what's healthy anymore. Nothing's healthy, you know, unless it's the raw stuff. We have a clip here from Fed Up.
Yeah, it's talking about something you didn't know, Steve, that our brains are tempted by bad food.
There you go.
Every day.
Okay.
We like to think we make rational decisions, but the fact is our brains are getting constantly hijacked. You can't walk in most cities, most places, more than 100 feet without having your brain being activated in some way.
Gas stations used to sell gas. Now they're all convenience stores. And there's junk food at the checkout everywhere. At toy stores, at drug stores. Go to buy stationery supplies, linens, electronics. Every store these days has junk food right at the eye level of your kids.
And then you add the emotional gloss. You add other things. You add favorite cartoon characters. Right? You make it into entertainment. You add toys. And then you add the carnival-like features. You add all these other layers of stimuli. And in the end, you end up with one of the great public health epidemics of our time.
Okay, that's from the film Fed Up. Let's go to some phone calls here. Let's go to Jenny from Kansas City, Missouri. Jenny, welcome back to the show. Nice to have you.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for having me back.
This is Jenny from the Underground Supper Club, right?
Yes, exactly.
Great. Good to have you.
Thank you. Well, I just had a comment about the movie Chef, obviously. And I'm not a chef myself, but obviously I work with a lot of chefs at Test Kitchen. And, you know, this movie really speaks to the heart of every chef's life. And I think if you're not in the food industry, you might not have the same appreciation for how this movie truly speaks to the everyday life of a chef. And I think, you know, your point about, you know, he wanted freedom, he wanted to be able to cook his food, and now he's stuck on a food truck doing the same sandwich every day.
Right.
The truth is he has control. And that's what every chef's looking for. So he can add or change anything on that menu at any time because he is 100% cooking his food, his vision.
That's a great point.
Well, as the truck moved through New Orleans, they added beignets because it was a regional specialty, right?
Right.
So the ultimate answer is he has now control of his universe. He doesn't have to answer to anybody else. And that's really, truly, I think, the heart of this movie. I absolutely loved it. I've seen it probably three times now. And chefs to go see it.
No, Jenny, that's an excellent point. I think you're making a great point, and I'll buy it from you. I like that. Appreciate it.
There you go.
Thanks, Jenny. All the best.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Let's go to Diana from Leawood. Diana, welcome to Up to Date. Good morning.
Hi. Well, I took my son the Chef, thinking he would love Chef, and he really thought it was just, he was very unimpressed. He didn't think it was very realistic, and I don't know. Maybe I took him to too many movies like Sleepless in Seattle when he was growing up, and he just thought this was way too, just kind of mundane.
All right.
Diana. I liked it, but I was a little bit disappointed, too. I thought it needed to have a little bit more meat.
I hear you. Great.
Good pun.
Good pun. Good pun, Diana. Good Friday pun. I appreciate it. All right.
All righty. Thank you.
Thank
Bye-bye.
You. Cynthia, give us a 10-second review of Fading Gigolo. Woody Allen's in it. It's about a florist who becomes an unlikely gigolo.
It's lightweight, low-key, just a nice summer diversion showing at Screenland Crown Center and Liberty Hall in Lawrence.
And Bob Butler, what's happening at the library that you got to tell me quickly here?
Okay, tomorrow, You Can't Cheat an Honest Man, the great W.C. Fields down at the Film Vault. That's Saturday at the Film Vault downtown. And last month we had 200 people show up for Brave New World, our 1984 movie musical series. This month on the 20th. Breaking. We're going to have live break dancers, free samples from Casey Beer. It's fun.
Cynthia?
The movie both these gentlemen thinks is one of the best of the year, Night Moves, opens next weekend.
Oh, okay. We'll talk about it next time you guys are on. I want to thank film professor Cynthia Haynes, KCUR Steve Walker, and Bob Butler. Read his reviews at butlercinemascene.com. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Great job, guys.
Yep.